This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hi, 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 and welcome back to Shift Talking. I'm Davina Hain, your mental health coach and professional friend, here to help you build a life that is unfuckwithable. I'm just very particular about where things get cut, and I'm annoying about it. And so it ends up taking me so long, like hours a week.
I get it.
It's unnecessary, though.
You have the end product in mind, and the frustration ratchets up when the technology does not merge perfectly or dovetail with the vision.
100%. So I have to adjust that. And it's almost, I think a lot of us fall into this trap of like, well, no one's going to edit it like I do. It's like, well, no, they will probably do a better job because that's what they do for a living and you don't. So,
well, how about if you consider this? Instead of considering whether one person's going to edit it like you would or somebody's going to do it better or, you know, whatever, ask yourself, in the grand scheme of things, how important is it that this be perfect?
Yeah, that's the question of all questions. I'm really at this point in my life, my business, my like the work that I'm doing on myself, my parenting, there's so much of that that I'm really working on getting out of these perfectionist tendency things that either I do it entirely how I envisioned it or I don't do it at all. And it harms me so much.
So whose voice is it that you keep hearing that's telling you that it's got to be perfect?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's mine. I think it was some level of conditioning.
I want you to pause. Hold on.
Yeah.
I want you to just pause for just a moment. Close your eyes. Take a deep breath. And see yourself way back when. You were really excited about something that you had done, some achievement that you had, and you go running into the adults in your life and you express this excitement about what you have done. And be really honest, what was the reaction that you got, and was it what you were expecting?
So the one that comes to mind was, it wasn't as enthusiastic, maybe, as I expected. And I was also interrupting what they were trying to get done. And so I think that played into it. And kind
How old
of.
Were you?
3 or 4. I taught myself how to ride a bike. And I was stoked.
Okay, so you were three or four years old. Mm-hmm. You taught yourself how to ride a bike. That's a huge achievement. You were very, very excited. You go running in to tell the adult about your major accomplishment, and they responded with less than an enthusiastic response. I don't have time for you right now.
Hmm. So it was my mom. She had her checkbook. She was writing checks for all of our bills. And she was like, I did come in and I remember this so clearly that I ran in and I was like, Mommy, I just pedaled 4 times. And she did say like, oh, good, sweetie. Like it wasn't ignored, and it wasn't like, ugh, okay, great, like, go do you. It was very loving.
But?
And And it just wasn't like as excited as I was.
So do you see how you were taught way back when you went in with that excited reaction? You were so excited to share about that bike. Yes, she did respond to you lovingly, but her level of enthusiasm was not what you were expecting. It was not what you were hoping. It's not what you were even anticipating. Mm-hmm. And so as a consequence, your little 3-4-year-old mind probably said, maybe I didn't pedal enough times for her to be as excited as I would have thought that she might have been. Maybe if I would have, you know, gone half the block. Anyway, your mind, whether you were aware of it or not aware of it, started telling yourself a story. And so then if you are the youngest of 4 children, I'm the oldest of 6, so I get wow. this thing. The youngest one is 8 years younger than I am. Anyway, if your brother is an addict and your mother is obviously struggling, because I can only imagine all of the stuff that she was feeling, you know, with regard to his addiction, you probably did feel as if, I've got to be perfect. I've got to wear this white dress, white socks, white shoes with a white bow in my hair, and they must be blindingly white at all times. If I get one tiny speck on here, it's going to upset the whole apple cart, and that is all my fault.
Yeah, I know some of my narrative ended up sounding like other things are just more important, right? Like the bills that she was paying were just more important. My father's
business.
But you
business, see, that's that, what you were taught.
That were just more important.
That's what you were taught.
Yeah. How do we differentiate that from my perception versus what they taught?
You start asking yourself, what did I really want in that moment? And what did I really receive in that moment? And where has this shown up later in my life? Did I lower my expectations? Don't cast blame. History is history. Last time I checked, we couldn't change it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
How big is your rear view? How big is the rear view mirror in your car?
Mm-hmm.
We check that for information. We check that for understanding of what's in front of us.
Hmm.
So if you're feeling this, if you had this expectation, ask yourself that question. You know, when was the first time I remember this? What was going on? What was happening? When was the next time I remember this? What was my reaction? What did I want to have happen? Mm-hmm. And then ask yourself, was this person able to give me what I was expecting? And if the answer is no, you say, okay. But here's the other
piece. Do you question whether expectations were too much or unrealistic or impractical?
Your expectations are your expectations. Mm. They are never too much. They are never impractical. They are never anything more than your expectation. You are in charge of you. You are in control of you. You are not in control of anybody else.
Right.
And when we're children, we don't understand how we fit into the world. And we also have this view that we are so powerful. And at the same time, we know that we are so powerless.
Mm. Mm.
So we try and do things to keep from rocking the boat.
Yeah.
I was, my youngest son and his wife gave me this book, I Want to Hear Your Story, Mom, and I was filling it out. And it asked some really pointed questions. It took me 3 months to answer, you know, these short answer questions, because I didn't like how I was feeling as I was responding. And one of the questions was, how did you feel as you were growing up? And I thought about it a long time, and I didn't answer it for a long time. And finally I wrote, I was trying to figure out where I belonged. You know, and it sounds to me like you and your life circumstance, you know, the foundation there, you were having to parent and sibling yourself in order to not get your a drop of dust or anything on your white dress and your white socks and your white shoes and that white hair bow. Mm. And that's the story that you told yourself. So I can only imagine the conversations that you have with yourself. I can only imagine the chastisement that you have with yourself and how you speak to yourself and about yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's the problem with that. The way we speak to and about ourselves, the way we treat ourselves, the way we deny ourselves in order to take care of others, we are teaching the world that the world can deny us, that the world can speak to us, that the world can treat us, that the world can expect from us these things. And when we push back on the world gets really confused because it's like, hold on, wait a minute. I am observing what you are doing. I am hearing what you are saying. I am seeing the consequences of your behavior.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Why do you have a problem with me doing these things? So if we simply look at our past as being our past. It is what it is. Last time I checked, nobody had a rewind.
Right.
Nobody gets a mulligan. Nobody gets a redo. Right? Mm-hmm. There's only here. There's only now. So we start asking ourselves, what was going on in that moment? And then we look at this moment where we're feeling that moment's feelings. And we say, okay, well, that explains why I'm feeling this right now. Let me see if I can work my way through it right now. And what I do is I have written conversations with myself. And I'll say, well, of course you're feeling that way. Why wouldn't you be feeling that way? This is what was going on. Of course you felt that way. Yes, I can only imagine how sad you were. I can see why you would be sad right now in this moment. And I came to an understanding, a conclusion that's working, you know, that even if I were to hand you a script detailing everything I wanted you to say, how I wanted you to say it, how I wanted you to stand, your eye motion, your hand motion, everything, and you were to read the script and act it out exactly as I detailed it out, I would feel this twinge of inauthenticity. I would feel this twinge of being let down. Because it wasn't your honest reaction. It was what I was expecting you to do. So I go back to, I'm only in control of me. You're in control of you. So if your reaction is not up to my expectation, you know what? That's okay. That's okay. I can live with that. I can live with your expectation not being up, your reaction not being up to my expectation. But you know what? I can have that written conversation with myself, and I can tell myself, I am so proud of you. I am so excited. I can only imagine how you were feeling when you did that. I know it was so hard for you, or it was so easy. And good gravy, that is so exciting. And let's just celebrate for a moment. And can you feel the difference?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm there's sorry so much, I hijacked the conversation.
Please don't be sorry. This is, I had previously been doing this podcast entirely solo. And then in the last few weeks, I've opened it up to guests, and I'm just so glad that I did. It's so nice and refreshing and beautiful. I recognize how fortunate I am to be able to have these types of conversations day in and day out. And then every so often I go out into the world and I'm like, oh, right. Like, I'm super privileged in there to be surrounded by people who are doing similar work or doing the work and, you know, staying mindful and cognizant. And then it just, you know, you get smacked with reality of like, oh, I'm in a bubble. Oh, this doesn't quite, like, this doesn't quite match the rest of the world. And it's just, it's beautiful. We didn't even introduce ourselves. We just jumped right into it. It's amazing. Hi.
How are you?
I am well. I am healing. I am still, my wheels are turning.
That's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good thing. And I spent so much of my life just running away from myself and running to others to tell me about me and to, you know, tell me I'm okay and gauge how I should feel based on how they're feeling. And so now it's a really beautiful experience to be doing this work and just, you know, sit in it. It's a privilege for me to know and get to know myself in ways that I didn't before and actually feel like I'm leading with curiosity about myself versus ridicule or judgment or, you know, looking for a culprit of some kind.
And truthfully, there are no culprits. I mean, you know, we are not victims. I love that you mentioned that you're, you know, leading with curiosity. One of the questions that I always say in my kids, like, what do you really want to know, Mom? I'll say, I'm just curious, you know, da-da-da-da. And I even do that in my written conversations. You know, I'm just curious, what was going on? I'm just curious, why were you thinking that was okay? Or I'm just curious, why did you do that? But like I said, my kids, when I start a sentence like that, they're like, okay, Mom, what do you really want to know? But the reason that I do that is when we open with, I'm just curious, it's a, you know, what's following is not going to be judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times we're judgmental, especially towards ourselves. So if we can be curious and even go so far as to use the sentence, I'm just curious. And like I said, my kids are like, oh, Mom, yeah. We can discover things that we never thought we would discover. Mm-hmm. Because we're not judging. We're not prejudging. We're not prejudiced about the answer.
Yeah.
And isn't the answer often something that you weren't expecting?
When I give myself time to actually think my answer through, yes. Right? Oftentimes I used to have like this false sense of knowledge, I think, like almost not being willing. I would feel very small if I was corrected on something or if I didn't know something, and I would lead with just giving an answer right away.
Well,
and I think I did this in the start of this call, which is why you paused me. You had me slow down.
But you know, right? That goes back to you believing you had to have everything right there. You were taught that you had to have everything right there, that nobody had time to answer your questions. So it was important that you become Encyclopedia Brown and you know everything and it be at your fingertips.
Yeah.
You know, you can envision yourself carrying around, you know, all 26 books of the 26th volume encyclopedia, in one arm. And then you've got, you know, the world atlases in the other arm, and you're balancing the dictionaries and the thesauruses on top of your head because you believe that all the world's knowledge must be at your fingertips or you're a failure.
Yeah, like that brings me value.
But it doesn't just bring you value, it defines you.
Mm. Yeah.
Because if you don't know
the answer.
And
that is my imposter syndrome wrapped up in a bow.
Oh my gosh, don't get me started on imposter syndrome. Holy Toledo.
Your perception.
No, I struggle with that on a daily basis.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I often laugh at myself. Yes, I do laugh at myself because people are like, wait, what? You're an introvert? You struggle with imposter syndrome? Because I do a really, really good job of pretending that I'm not.
For a similar reason as me, you think?
Well, probably. I'm the oldest of six kids. My mother, the youngest one's 8 years younger than I am. You know, who had my next sibling is a year younger than I am.
Wow.
The next one is 3 years younger. I mean, who had time for me? Mm. When I was getting married, it was actually right before we found out my mother was dying. But anyway, when I was getting married, my mother said, I'm so glad it's you because you're the responsible one. But now, what kind of weight is that to carry?
Yeah.
What kind? Yeah. And so, you know, you're struggling with feeling terrified and afraid and, you know, what am I going to do? And, you know, those voices are all hollering in your head, but the world is saying, well, she's all pulled together. She's got it all, you know? So you have to put forth that facade, that persona. But what I do now is I have realized when I'm talking to people like you, I can be honest. Is the imposter syndrome still there? Yes, I'm not going to lie about that. It is still there. But we can do things afraid anyway, can't we? Mm-hmm. Being brave does not mean that you're courageous and you're Hercules and you're all that kind of stuff. No, being brave means you do it anyway, no matter what you're feeling. Mm. And so now in this point in my life, after figuring all this mess out, I do things even if I'm terrified. Because I know, just like you, there's someone else, there's another Leslie out there, there's another Davina out there who is desperate to hear that they're okay and that they are enough just as they are in this moment and that they're not broken and that their voice is worthy of being heard and they have a contribution to make, but the first thing they need to do is learn to love themselves. Learn to have those conversations, those honest, honest conversations with themselves and admit those deep, dark secrets so that they can get those hamsters off those wheels and send them back to the pet market and let's put the pet markets out of business.
Yeah.
Because until we do that, we're going to continue people-pleasing and believing that we need to be carrying around those 26 volumes of the encyclopedia and that giant collection of world atlases and the dictionaries and the thesaurus is stacked on top of our heads. Mm-hmm. When truthfully, that's not the real answer. And that's not who we are.
Yeah, and as I've continued through this work, there's been a part here about so much compassion and forgiveness that I can give myself. That before it felt like self-forgiveness was a cop-out. And unless somebody else tells me that they forgive me, then like I'm just letting myself get away with something. And like how real, you know, what does that actually look like? Whereas now I can recognize that I can have compassion for myself, figure out, learn with curiosity what I was looking to achieve and where I just missed the mark potentially. Maybe my impact was poor, even though my intention was good. And allow for that to be the forgiveness because I'm altering. I'm adjusting based on the evidence that I'm being given. That then that has become so much more fuel for me to be more confident and trust myself more and have more respect for myself and like myself, which is a wild thing. I don't think I ever did that prior to like now at all. There was just so much of that. And yeah, I'm raising these two little humans, these little boys that are 5 and 8. And there's so much there that I want to model for them and show them what these things can sound like And it's not about perfect or not erroring. It's error, fuck up. You're going to, it's going to be atrocious. And then here's how we can move through it. And I actually just got out of another interview right before we got in here. And I was sharing that my husband and I now, through all of the work that we've done, and we're celebrating his 4-year sobriety next month. And he's just amazing. And we really broke our marriage completely down, nearly separated, and chose.
Well, you had to.
A narrative. Yeah. And now when we're in conflict, we invite our boys to watch us repair so they can see what this sounds like. Not just, hey, I heard them yelling, and then later on they're like lovey-dovey in the kitchen and not know how we got there. And so I'm trying to show them these narratives, give them the...
Well, you're trying to build skills.
Yes. Yes.
Because the way children learn skills is by observing. Hmm. But I'd like to spin back for just 1 second. You said it was hard for you to forgive. Of course it was hard for you to forgive because you believed that you had to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't perfect, you simply screwed up, you messed up, and there was no forgiveness to it. It was just, you know, shame comes raining in, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I recognized is when I forgive myself, it's either I say, you know what, I messed up, move on. Mm-hmm. Or I will say, oh, well, move on. But the thing to me that's really important about forgiving ourselves is making a hard line in the sand and saying, okay, right here, I'm saying I forgive myself, or oh, well, or whatever phrase you want to come up with. Mm-hmm. Multitudes. I've got multitudes. And then step over the line and keep going.
Yeah.
Because the important part about forgiving ourselves is not holding on to it. Because if you hold on to it, you really haven't forgiven yourself. Can you take the opportunity to learn? Yes, that's different. If we are forgiving somebody out there, maybe not to their face, let's say there's somebody who has harmed you in whatever fashion, and we need to release ourselves from the prison that we allowed them to put us into, we can say, I forgive you, but that doesn't mean we forget. It means that we look at our boundary and we repair our boundary so that whatever they did to us doesn't happen again. So the same thing with our personal self. When we make a mistake, when we mess up, we say, you know what, I forgive myself. Oh, well, I'm moving on. But we check our personal boundary. Okay, what was going on that happened, that my boundary got broken or flexed or whatever, so that we can learn. We can take those opportunities to learn. And then you're talking about, you know, the conflict resolution with your husband. I think it's brilliant that you're teaching your kids how to constructively resolve conflict. Oh my gosh, we don't have enough of that these days. Holy Toledo. Because that's them at 5 and 8. I have 3 boys. Okay, so I get the whole boy thing. And my objective, somebody asked me when they were a little bit younger than yours are, about the same age. They said, how is it being a boy mom? And I said, I'm doing my best to raise kind, caring, and compassionate men. Mm-hmm. So that when they get married, they marry someone who is kind and compassionate and helps them to become the best versions of themselves. Now, accidentally, through all my messed upness, I accidentally did that. But I had been deliberate, even though But when we model for children, young children, when we model healthy behavior, it's going to become so much a part of their, not their DNA, but their bones, that they will be able to carry that forward into adulthood. And isn't that what we're really trying to do? We're trying to raise teenagers who can stand on their own 2 feet against whatever, you know, the world is throwing at them, and be able to not necessarily defend their position, but be able to stand in their position while the world is raging around them. Because those teenagers are going to become healthy adults who are going to be responsible for the next generation. So the work that you're doing, if you'll just pause and give your you and your husband a giant high five, what you're doing is not impacting those boys. It's impacting the generations to come. Mm. Because you don't live in a bubble. They are not going to live in a bubble. When you visualize how many people they're going to come in contact with, and then their offspring, they're going to be in contact with their offspring, and then their offspring, and then their offspring. Do you see how actually the hard work of the hard work is not here in the present? The hard work of the hard work is out there where we are never going to see it.
Yeah. Man, you know, I'm launching this program. It's called The Parental Shift, and it has really nothing to do with child development or sleep schedules or, you know, anything like that. It's entirely about parents, like letting us as individuals, as couples, as people do the work and know how to regulate and how to have it not be so hard. There's a lot of that I wasn't born to be a parent. I have this anecdotal theory that we're either born to be a parent or partner or neither. And that we can be both, but we view the world through likely one of those lenses. And I was not born to be a parent. Nothing came naturally. You'll just know. No. Nothing.
Well, given your growing up situation, of course you didn't. It's like me. Yeah. I mean, I'm the oldest of six kids. The youngest is 8 years younger than I am. It says in this book that I was talking about, you know, what did you think about being a mother or whatever? And I said, honestly, I never thought about being a mother. I wanted to be a buyer for a large retail store, live in New York in an apartment, have three tiny toy poodles, a dog walker, and use my oven to store books. Nowhere in there was being a wife or a mother. Nowhere.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's just a wild thing. And I'm curious to hear how you became a parent, right? Like outside of like the, you know, there was that part that, you know, my husband and I were just like, you know, I have another month before my birth control gets refilled. Let's just see what happens. And then didn't even get a period, pregnant within 3 weeks. And then it was like, oh, fuck.
Now what?
We talked about having like a baby, but not about a kid and a teenager. And
that's the funny thing. You know, you have this baby and then it's like, oh,
forever, all the time,
all the time,
forever. Like it's a trap.
Yes. As they say in that one movie, forever. Sandlot.
The Sandlot. I had no perception of
the. I really have to laugh. The way that we ended up having the first child was I was like, well, I guess it's time. But I felt, and it was not pressure that was coming from the outside, even though it kind of sort of, but not really. Mm-hmm. I just thought this is what you did. Okay. Right. So we were married. We'd been married almost 2 years. I thought, well, this is what you did. You have a baby. Anyway, it ended up that the timing was good or bad, depending upon which way you look at it. 2 days after we found out we were having the baby, the cancer severed my mother's spinal cord. She was paralyzed from her armpits down. She ended up dying 2 weeks before the baby was born. And he was born 3 weeks early because of the stress that I was under. But I can still remember sitting alone in my house and thinking, now how do I be a mother? You know, and I tell people, I had Leave It to Beaver's mother, June Cleaver, and then there was this other show, The Donna Reed Show. Those were my role models for how to be a mother. that mm-hmm. you dress to the nines, complete with pantyhose, pearls, you know, the whole makeup and everything. And I also tell people, for the first 7 weeks of that child's life, that's what I did. I would get up, I would, you know, do whatever, but then I'd, you know, wash and dry my hair. I had makeup. I had, you know, I was dressed to the nines until I went back to work. Then it was too much of a struggle to try and, you know, juggle the baby. And I had to drive into town. It was close to an hour, and then drive back out close to an hour. So that kind of went to the wayside. But now I say my role model is Malcolm in the Middle's mother. She knew how to be a parent. She knew how to fight the important battles. She knew how to let the battles that didn't matter go to the side. She knew how to figure out a way for the kids to find their own way to discover what was important. Hmm. You know, did you ever watch Malcolm in the Middle?
Here and there. I can picture Mom. I don't have a
hysterical.
Whole...
Hysterical. Well, yeah, I don't my youngest, have that image. I have my older two are 9 and 11 years older than my youngest one. Mm. Okay, so I got a do-over, so
round
to speak.
Round two, yeah.
But and he often said, Mom, it's not fair that you had Philip and Jeffrey because you already know everything. But the number one thing that I realized and began to understand, don't ask me why. It had to be, you know, that somebody was looking after me. I realized and figured out from the very early onset, pick and choose your battles. Not everything is a battle. So I never fought battles over hair. I never fought battles over clothes. I never fought, you know, there are a lot of battles over things. I didn't fight battles over what they ate. Did we have special meals? No. You know, if they were through eating, they were through eating. But oftentimes people would push back on me. How come your boy's hair is so long? How come this? How come? I'm like, you know, you have to let it fall on deaf ears. So for you and your husband to be modeling this kind of behavior, you know, for your boys, can you see the type of adults that you're raising? And that's what you have to look at. It's not just the type of adult they are going to become, but what is the impact way out there
that they'll have? And you put it so eloquently about what your hopes were for your kids. And I just say, I don't want to raise fuck boys. It's like really just where I'm at. I want them to be present and aware of themselves and cause harm, of course, because they will, and know what to do with it afterward, you know? And my husband and I are just such different people. Our values are the same. And our principles are similar. And the way that we view the world is so different. And he's so harsh and I'm so gentle. And sometimes we switch. And it's just, there's just so much here that I'm really at the end of each of these days, I'm just hopeful that I will get to see and experience them as adults and see what, you know.
But wouldn't you say, with regard to you and your husband, and probably part of the drive to create the parental shift, is you actually married your family. And because that's what you were comfortable with. That's what you knew. That's where you knew that you fit in. You knew that that's what your role was. So if you guys went through this process where you tore your marriage down and then you built it back up again, and as you were both healing individually and together as a couple, you have to, each person has to make a decision, where am I going to be in this orbit? I either, as individually you're changing, the other person has to make a decision to either change too, or they get kicked out to Pluto.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I can only imagine the tension that was going on and probably still continues, because each of you are still continuing to grow and to evolve. And so each day, as you're incrementally changing and shifting, the other person has to make a conscious decision. They may not be aware that they have to make a conscious decision. They've got to make a conscious decision. Am I going to change enough to stay close, or am I going to kick them out to Pluto?
Yeah.
And when I made the decision way back in 2016 that I was going to get healthy mentally, physically, and emotionally, I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell a single soul, mainly because I didn't want to hear from the, you know, I just didn't want to hear from the, what I call, you know, the karma police or the behavior police or the Weight Watcher. I didn't want to hear from anybody. So I kept it to myself. And about 3 or 4 months after I started the work, my husband turned and he said, you know, I'm not sure what's going on. And I'm not sure if I like it. And I just sat there. Actually, I was standing. And I didn't respond. I just left him to ponder his own words. And what I recognized, he's not a very emotive person. But what I recognized is apparently I was doing something that was creating tension that was at a level that he was observing it. And as I had the written conversation with myself the next day, I said, he's the one who has to make the decision. I'm going to continue the work that I'm doing. He's got to make a decision. And I continued moving forward. Does he still feel tension every now and then? Yes. Mm-hmm. But you know what? What he feels is what he feels, and what I feel is what I feel. And I need to make sure that I'm taking care of myself, not to the exclusion of him.
Sure.
But making certain that I am prioritizing what it is that I need, because we cannot pour from an empty cup. Mm-hmm. So when we, especially, you know, like yourself, you're programmed to be the caretaker, you're programmed to be the peacemaker, you're programmed to make certain that, you know, everything is just so that we don't upset the apple cart and other people are upset. I can only imagine when your husband falls a little tiny bit off of, you know, his work, the tension that you feel to try and rush in and fill the vacuum to fix it.
Oh, absolutely.
So absolutely. What you can do in that moment when you feel that tension build to rush in and fix the vacuum, grab pen and paper. Ask yourself, what's going on right now? What am I really feeling in this moment? What do I want to have happen? How do I want it to look? What do I want to see next?
Yeah, and you know, over time, what I've recognized is that each time that I have instead just gone to fix it and gave suggestions, or do you want to catch a meeting maybe, or, you know, these types of things. There's receptiveness and, you know, an acknowledgement of, oh yeah, yeah, I haven't gone to a meeting in a couple of days. Like, let me head out. And other times it wasn't, right? Because I don't want you to tell me what to do. That's not going to work for me. And then often what I've kind of recognized now is, okay, there is something here for me. And then I leave him to do whatever it is that he needs to do. And almost always he'll be the one to come and be like, hey, I'm feeling kind of today. I'm going to go catch a meeting, or I'm going to go for a drive, or, you know, whatever this is. And it's what I recognized was a lack of trust in myself and also sometimes him because of fear of returning to the autopilot of the two 20-somethings that got us here, you know? And it scares me. There is a deep fear that I have of that. And because I know what it looks like and it felt familiar, and sometimes I get caught up in the familiarity of it, that I can't, right? It's at this point that when I'm in those kinds of modes, we're able to catch it faster and faster. And sometimes I'm just like, yeah, I kind of need to be in this mode today and just leave it be. And it's an incredible thing.
If you do catch yourself, if you do, you know, make the comment about, hey, you know, consider doing whatever. And then you realize, oh, wait, hold on. I was trying to fix. I was trying to be responsible for him. I was trying to tell him he wasn't being responsible for himself. When it's quiet, go back to him and say, you know what? I want to apologize. I said da-da-da-da, or when such and such was going on, this is what I said. Mm-hmm. That wasn't my responsibility, and I just want to apologize to you for having even thought it, having even said it. I know that you were doing your very best to take care of you. So just wanted to let you know I'm apologizing for that. And I'm doing my best to make certain that I'm giving you space to take responsibility for you, just as you were giving me space to take responsibility for me. Now, you know what? That will give him an opportunity to think back. Okay, this is what was going on. This is what I could have done. This is what I did do. And this is what I felt in the moment. But the other benefit, this is huge. The other benefit is if possibly your boys are anywhere in earshot when either one of you is apologizing or you're apologizing, they are going to learn it is okay to admit you made a mistake.
Yes.
And we use I statements, not you statements. We focus on behavior, not people. Mm-hmm. And when you feel that rising up of trying to tell him what to do, grab your pen and paper. Grab it. Start having that written conversation. And then you can actually circle back when he resolves the situation. Mm-hmm. You can circle back to him and say, you know what? I'm so glad you went to the meeting, or I'm so glad you did whatever it was. This is what was going on for me in that moment.
Yeah.
And I'm just really so grateful that you went ahead and took care of yourself.
Yeah, acknowledging it.
Well, here's the other piece of that. Do you have dogs or cats, or you have kids, right?
Yeah, right. Two boys, a dog, and a cat.
Okay, well, there we go. There's this book called Don't Shoot the Dog. Now, do not get upset. It's not about shooting dogs.
No, I've heard, but I don't remember what that is.
Okay. It's about training animals. And really and truly, the secret is it's not about training the animal. It's about training the human. It's about training the human to acknowledge what the animal is doing that you want it to continue. Hmm. So let's say, for example, you've got this new puppy and the puppy sits. Well, you want the puppy to sit, right? So you say, oh, good job, and you give it a treat. Mm-hmm. And the puppy, after three or four times, it gets a treat because it sat down. It starts recognizing that if I sit down, I'm going to get a treat. And then you start adding in the command. This works with kids. It works with husbands. Trust me. If we start acknowledging the things that we want to continue, let's say, for example, your kids fold up the bath towel and they hang it properly. And maybe that's something they haven't done. But the first time you observe it, you comment, you know, thank you so much for folding the bath towel and hanging it up. I really appreciate it. Period. They're going to look at you weird. Don't worry about it. The next time they do it, you say the same thing. But if they don't fold it, if they don't hang it up, you don't say a word. Not a word. Now, maybe you pick it up and you fold it and you hang it up, but you don't say a solitary word. Because what you want to do is you want to reward what you want to continue, and you want to absolutely, totally, completely ignore that behavior that you want to stop.
Wow.
So can you think and visualize how this plays out with your kids? Can you think and visualize how it plays out with your husband? But more importantly, can you think and visualize how it would play out with you personally? How sometimes you celebrate, how sometimes you've done something amazing, and then you start catching yourself, but you stop yourself from criticizing yourself, and you say, oh, wait a minute, hold on. I want to give myself a high five because I was celebrating myself instead of criticizing. That's so amazing. Do I run around like a lunatic doing that? Yes, I do. For bigger stuff, I tell Alexa to play Do You Believe in Life After Love by Cher at full volume, and I dance and I sing.
Get it. Yeah, I mean, it really is a wild thing that when many of us, right, do what we should be doing. There's no celebration, there's no acknowledgement, right? And when we do what we shouldn't or what causes harm or we regret, we will
beat ourselves up.
We will sit on that for decades if we need to.
Lose the word should from your vocabulary.
Yeah.
Do not use the word should at all. Mm. Instead, you know, make a decision. It's a choice. I'm choosing. Mm. I choose to do this, not should. Mm. Because should carries with it that thing that we are so familiar with, shame. Should and shame travel together.
Mm.
So when we talk about what we should and shouldn't be doing, we are imposing on ourselves, we're telling ourselves there's a set of rules and regulations which your perfectionistic self craves rules and regulations, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want boundaries, solid boundaries. You want all these rules, all these regulations. Just tell me what I need to do so I can follow it. But when we release ourselves from the prison of should and we say, you know what, I've got a choice. I can make a choice. I can choose to do this. I can choose not to do this. This is something that I want to do. Let's also lose the word need. This is something I want to do. Can you feel the freedom that it opens up?
Yeah.
The possibility. It also gives you permission to fail. And I published a book last year called The Journey from Failing to Healing.
Yeah,
and the subtitle is How First Attempts in Learning Fail Can Lead to Healthy Emotions and Loving Yourself Heal.
Hmm.
So if we start visualizing the word fail as a first attempt in learning, when somebody tells us we're a failure, we can smile and shake their hand and say, yes, thank you so much for recognizing that. That was my first attempt.
Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to, there was a quote that I heard, I don't remember what it was, but it was basically that failure is the cost of admission. And there's this, right? Like doing podcasting and YouTube and socials, and there's just so much of, you know, there's so much opportunity for scrutiny and judgment and these types of things. And I get crippled by it sometimes. It feels overwhelming for me at times.
Well, of course
and
it does.
It's by these types of conversations that you're sharing and likely your book that I'm going to need to read. And these quotes that we hear, it allows for that then I'm more likely to welcome in challenges, welcome in acknowledgement of when I chose the path of more regret instead of least regret and allow for that to just exist and then try again. Right. And whereas, you know, back to the beginning of this call, it's just like either you go big or you go home. You get it right or you just don't start at all. And I'm working on living more within the gray, like done is better than perfect in these types of like mantras that I'm telling myself.
Why don't we consider progress? Perfection is overrated.
Yeah.
Every time we do something, every time we try something, every time we make an attempt at something, it's progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
Perfection is overrated.
I don't even, how would we even recognize it?
How would we even recognize what?
Perfection.
We have an image in our minds. We have it defined in our minds. It's kind of something that's a little bit nebulous, but we know. You know what I'm saying? We know when it's perfect. Well, you're never going to get there. You're never, ever, ever going to get there. So if we can release ourselves and we just recognize we're making progress, it's like, you know, if somebody gets mad because you make a mistake, you know, they're accidents. They're not on purposes. They're accidents. And I just wanted to throw in one thing on your parental shift deal real quick before I forgot it. When my kids were young, timeout was a big thing, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, I tried timeout. I struggled with it, and I decided I was an absolute failure at timeout. And so I was beating myself up because I was such a horrible failure at timeout.
Mm.
And it dawned on me one day, put the dadgum toy in timeout, not the kids.
Mm.
So from the time that my two big ones were small, like 3 and 1, I would put toys in timeout. I would say, you know, it looks like right now the Legos, the whatever, are having a hard time following the rules, so they just need to go sit in timeout for a little while, and then they can come back. And that was the end of my discussion. Mm-hmm. And I'd pick them up, put them where they couldn't get to them, and, you know, walk off. And, you know, they may have squawked or hollered about, you know, the thing going, but it would be quiet in just a few moments. Mm-hmm. Now, what was the benefit to that? First of all, they weren't sitting some random place for a specific amount of time, and I wasn't arguing with them to stay in that spot until they whatever.
Yep.
But the other benefit was I had laid down the groundwork for later in their life. Oh, the other thing, I hate people saying you have to share. Oh my gosh, no.
Oh, mm-hmm.
No. They would have special toys, and they wouldn't want the other kid or whatever to play with those toys. I'd say, you know something, this is something that's special to you. Let's just put it up until this person has gone home. And they'd be quite all right with that because they no longer had to defend their territory. So yeah. Instead of telling kids that they have to share, if we demonstrate sharing with them, and we can even use the words, I'm going to share my whatever, you know, with you. Then we're modeling. But if we can also teach them that when they have things that are special, things that are precious to them, that they do not have to share them. It can be put away until the person is gone. Can you see how later in their life they're going to learn that things that are precious to them, things that are important to them, can be put away and the other person has no access to it?
Yeah, I mean, they learn to be selective.
Right.
Yeah.
And when they get to be older and they get cell phones and computers and iPads and all those kinds of things, mm-hmm. and they're not following the rules, guess what can go into timeout and doesn't get grounded?
Yeah. Yeah. What's it like to see your children become parents?
They are amazing parents. And as I said, I have zero clue how they did it. My youngest one will tell you that he was raised by wolves. But the cool thing, especially about the youngest one, and I see their daughter more than I see my other two grandkids, because I actually took care of my granddaughter 4 to 5 days out of the week for over the past almost year and a half. They are very, especially my son's wife, very open and forthright about verbalizing emotions and teaching her, you know, to verbalize. So here's this little 14-month-old talking about she's frustrated.
Yeah.
And amazing. And she's using it in the correct context.
Mm-hmm.
She's frustrated, or she's mad, or she's sad, and she's using it in the correct context.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine what kind of adult she's going to be?
Right. I mean, it's amazing considering how many adults we struggle to even identify, put a label on the vocabulary, the literacy of these types of things. It's incredible.
Well, what I realized, and I talk about it at the beginning of my book, You Can't Eat Love, and I'm almost finished right now with my next book, which is called Learning to Trust. I have to read the title because I can't remember the title. But it's called Learning to Trust Your Emotions. What Color Is My Shirt? How to Stop Running, Start Feeling, and Finally Trust Yourself.
Wow.
Because so many of us are really good at two emotions, being mad and being sad. And we don't believe that we have permission to experience anything else. So if it doesn't fit in one of those two categories, it's like, what do I do with this? You know, we just kind of...
Right. Brush past it.
Yeah, brush past it. Mm-hmm. And our bodies, which is how addictions, you know, can manifest. My drug of choice was food. Mm-hmm. But our bodies demand that the tension be released between our brain, which has been taught to dismiss, but our body still knows the truth. So the way we release the tension between what our body knows and what our mind is saying is we turn towards something that helps us release the tension. And oftentimes the way the tension is released is we're showered with shame. We can deal with that, can't we?
Right. It's familiar. Swim in it. Get pruney.
Yes. Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, I think we learn these types of things, I am notorious for saying that I eat my feelings. No doubt. And I know. Well, I'm recognizing how much comfort I get from it. That when I started noticing that when I'm starting to feel anything that doesn't feel super ideal, I tend to crave something. Like a certain flavor, or texture, a temperature. And what I used to do was more of like it's not good for me, I can't have that.
So shame came showering down.
Yeah, and instead it's just like, oof, I don't want it. Right? I want the flavor and the texture and all that, like zero doubt. And what it is that I'm thinking that will achieve for me and what I will feel later is unlikely to benefit me.
And but so in the moment, does it matter? The first thing you can do, and I do talk about this in this book, is stop labeling yourself as eating your emotions. Instead, reframe that to when I am feeling an emotion I am not comfortable with, I turn to food and put a period at the end of the sentence. Mm. Yeah. It opens you up to possibilities, because then you can grab that pencil and paper and you can say, okay, what is it that I'm struggling to not feel at this moment? When was the first time that I was feeling this? Why is it that I think food is going to solve this feeling? Because we've been taught, and I'm pretty certain that what you were taught, you know, way back when, was if you expressed some emotion that wasn't deemed appropriate, somebody probably handed you food. Or you have some relative somewhere in your life or some neighbor somewhere in your life who showed love through food.
Yeah, and treats and, yeah.
Yes, that's not love, that's control. So we, you know, our brain is always looking for a logical answer to things. The whole time our body is screaming, no.
Yeah.
But if we can acknowledge what our body is screaming, then our brain starts saying, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. And then we can freely feel what it is we're trying not to feel. And the need for that, whatever it is that we use to feed that before, starts subsiding. Now, if that doesn't work, what I recommend is you grab protein. Because when those cravings are set off, it's because there's a surge of sugar running through your body. And you know, anyway, it's a whole scientific thing. And I was on a podcast where this person actually validated what I had created in my own head. I was like, oh my gosh, she went through all the scientific whatever. But anyway, long story short, there's a surge of sugar that goes through your body. And then your body starts demanding that it produce more sugar. It's glycogen that's actually racing through your body. But the easiest way to bind that sugar that's racing through your body so that your body stops demanding producing more is to take protein. Consume protein, it binds the sugar, which calms down the body's need to produce more sugar.
Oh, wow.
So sugar, anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's...
That's Leslie's science, but...
No, it's so good to know these things. And there's this part that we are so quick to attribute certain challenges to the substance or what that is, right? Where my husband is an alcoholic, right? Labeled as an alcoholic, as opposed to somebody who had a lot of experiences in his upbringing that overwhelmed his ability to cope with it. And so that's what he used.
Yeah, that was what he turned to for comfort. That was what he found worked for him. And the other thing that... if we can remove those ick words. And instead, you know, somebody who is a diabetic, no, they're not a diabetic. They're someone who has diabetes. I have a son who has asthma. He's not an asthmatic. Let's not use those terms to define anyone. And where that was brought home to me was back when this child was 4 years old and almost died twice from asthma. I was reading a book, and the person who wrote it had a child who had asthma and said people kept calling him an asthmatic, and I didn't want him to be defined by his disease. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is so brilliant. Because how many times are we defining people by their disease? They're still people, last time I checked, right? And I imagine your husband has all kinds of wonderful qualities. And he's got to be an amazing person. Otherwise, you would not still be married to him. And you guys are raising amazing boys who are going to make an amazing impact on future generations. So let's just simply say he is someone who struggles with alcohol. That alcohol is his drug of choice for calming down all the stuff that he does not want to experience in real time. Yes. Just as somebody who struggles with eating, you know, they're not a foodaholic, they're not a chocoholic, they're not an emotional eater. They're simply someone who is struggling, and this is their drug of choice, what they use in order to calm themselves, to keep from feeling, to keep from experiencing what they're experiencing in real time. And can you feel the shift?
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely different. I had someone on the podcast yesterday who used he called it the hardening of categories that we're seeing, and that we are getting quicker to identify and label and categorize us and others into these very limiting, of course, and damaging types of categories that then make us feel as if we have to identify within it. And then all of the standardization that we have been trying to fight, right, for so much of our lives, we end up voluntarily putting ourselves within. And I do, of course, find importance in being able to acknowledge and recognize these things. And then we have to choose what we do with them. You know, and that's where I think it's... Oh, I'm listening.
I'm a huge proponent of categories. Because we can use categories to help us understand.
Right.
Just as... if I tell you that I'm driving a crossover and my husband is driving a pickup truck, you immediately understand what we are driving. So they're categories.
Right. Yeah.
Categories have an important place in the world to help us quickly and easily understand. However, the problem, as you said, we're having the hardening of labels. The problem is when we start labeling stuff. And when we label something rather than using it as a way to help us understand, then we are overriding whatever that person is with this one giant label.
Yeah.
And that doesn't open us up. That limits them in our worldview. It limits them into who they are. Now, I don't know about you, but I fall into all kinds of categories.
Yes.
They help you to understand who I am. They open your eyes up to the many things that I might be, but they allow you to quickly understand who I am, just as you have many categories, which allow me to quickly understand who you are. You are the wife of someone who's struggling with alcoholic. You are the mother of two amazing boys. You know, you come from a family that struggled with addiction. You know, those are the categories that you fall into, but they are not labels that define you. So let's stop defining people and let's just use them to understand, to help us to understand who they are, what they are, and why they are. Don't you think that we believe it is easier to fix someone else?
Yes. And it's also, it sounds more appealing, right? Like, let me show you where you're doing wrong And then it's your job to go fix it. But like, I'm cool. And that's very much what I used to do. It's why I got into anger management, was trying to fix my husband. He didn't want to find a provider. And he was, you know, we'd fight, he'd punch it, he'd storm out, I'd chase because, you know.
Of course you did.
Anxiousness. And it was that. And he wasn't. Yeah. And he wasn't open to doing the work. So I was like, okay, well, I just finished my master's. I don't want to do traditional therapy. It does not work for me. And let's, I'll get certified in anger management. I'll infiltrate from within and I'll learn something new in the process. And I didn't know what anger management was, honestly. It was just like, okay, well, this is where people go when then they're punching shit. And it was during that training that I sat in there and was just like, oh God, I'm part of the problem. Like, I'm contributing to this so much. No wonder this is so hard. And it was that for the longest time, because his behavior was so problematic, it took all the spotlight, all the attention.
Well, of course,
I didn't have to look at anything that I was doing, because he was taking all of it. I sat in the audience, perfectly happy, watching him just on stage, center stage.
Yeah.
And then of course, that's not sustainable. And I started recognizing these things within myself of, okay, well, that makes sense. And what is it that made me feel like it was okay to enable these behaviors? What made me override my intuition when I knew something was off and he told me it wasn't, and I found ways to shut myself down? Yeah. And convince myself that I can't trust my own perception of my own reality. You know, so many of these things came through, and it was so much easier of an existence. And I was just like, you're the fuck up, I'm cool though. Like, you go do you, and I'm going to sit back over here and like, what the fuck? And it just, you know, it's easier. It feels easier, but really it's suffering in a lot of ways.
The world tells us that, especially as females, and if we grow up in dysfunctional families, we really take it on more so. The world tells us that we are responsible for everyone else and that we need to deprioritize ourselves. So, yeah. Of course, you believe that it was your responsibility to make sure that he remained at center stage.
Yeah.
You were not the problem. No, you're there in your white dress, your white socks, your white shoes, and your white hair bow, spotless. Yep. You were not the problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like even for me personally, recognizing, holy Toledo, I am the problem. But you know what? I can only do something about me. I can't do anything about anybody else. Mm. And if I take care of me, if I'm clear and honest about my intentions, and I'm doing something out of kindness, caring, and consideration, then it should come across. I hate that word, but it will come across.
Yeah.
And how they pick it up, how they perceive it, that's not on me, that's on them. Mm-hmm. And I can just, you know, go on my merry way knowing that that was what my intention was. But when we start looking at ourselves and we start accepting that we are the problem, but we then go one step further and recognize we're only in charge of this little teeny tiny piece of the world. Yeah. We can have no impact on the rest of the world. Yeah. That's when things start shifting and changing. And how many times do we say, so-and-so made me mad? Yeah. So no one can make you anything except reservations for dinner, and I prefer a 5-star restaurant, and you pick up the tab.
Fair enough, yeah.
Well, then the other part of that is what you feel is what you feel. Nobody else gets a vote. If you are feeling sad in this moment, if you're feeling angry in this moment, even if you're feeling happy in this moment because somebody had karma visit them, how you feel is how you feel. Nobody else gets a vote. Let's stop doing emotions by committee.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's so true. I think before we were doing the work, when my husband and I were, you know, just living in our wounds, there was so much of that that I really did logically know that, like, I can't control him, and whether he chooses to drink is not my responsibility. And this, there was a gap between that of what I logically know and how to tolerate the discomfort of allowing that to be true. Do you have advice or guidance for bridging that gap over?
The written conversations. And the reason I keep emphasizing written conversations, who is available at 2 o'clock in the morning? Who doesn't care if you're talking about the same thing for the millionth time over the millionth day in a row? You. But if we start getting honest with ourselves and we start acknowledging honestly how we honestly, really and truly feel to ourselves, we become free. Now, I use an extreme example from my own life. Something had happened and I was really hurt. Trust was destroyed. And this person was ill and dying. And I was writing, having this conversation, and I was dancing all around how angry I was. And finally, I wrote down, "Who are you lying to?" And I paused and I said, "I'm lying to myself." And then I wrote, "I sees everything. Me and myself just want you to be happy. Now be honest." And I went on and I wrote, you know, how angry I was and how upset I was and how abandoned I felt. And, you know, I mean, all this stuff just poured out. And then I wrote, "I wish this person would hurry up and die."
Wow.
But once I did that, I felt liberated.
Yeah.
Because I was no longer beating back those wolves that kept trying to say, "This is what you're really feeling." Mm-hmm. So when we are in these frustrating situations where we truly are powerless, have those written conversations. Be honest. I don't care what you do with the paper after you finish writing on it. I never reread anything I write. Mm-hmm. Never. Mm-hmm. I have stacks of notebooks. I haven't read them. I'm trying to decide, do I want to leave them there for the boys to have proof that their mother really was, you know, insane? Or do I get rid of them? I don't know what I'm going to do. But I never reread anything, because unlike this conversation that's being recorded, if we were simply sitting down in, you know, a favorite coffee shop and you were enjoying whatever you like to drink and I was having my Diet Coke with no ice, please, there would be no recording of it, would there? So that's right. How I view those conversations with myself. So to answer your question, when we are in these situations where we are absolutely powerless over the other person's behavior, have a written, honest conversation with yourself. How do I really feel? What do I really wish would happen? What do I really wish that they would do? What do I really wish would be the outcome? And
And what I'm hearing is move through it, right?
Because exactly.
Sometimes I see that when we start writing things down, it almost, we ruminate and we kind of just go in a circle about it and maybe even like a doom loop versus acknowledging that I feel this way, acknowledging that it's gross, maybe that I don't love feeling this way or thinking in these ways, and just allowing for it to just be true. That like in this moment, this is how I feel without casting any judgment on it. Yeah.
And for me, the writing, I actually go back and forth with the conversation. So I will write down the question and then I'll write down the answer. And then I'm going back. So it's an actual dialogue. There are no quotes and punctuation is, you know, all over the place.
Yeah.
But for me, it's been far more beneficial, because when I start the hamsters running on the wheels in my head, they tend to keep on going and they occupy so much brain space. But when we have that written conversation and we feel as if we are talking to someone who is actually listening to us, and I acknowledge myself, of course you're feeling that way. Why wouldn't you? I can only imagine what was going on in that moment. I can only imagine how you were feeling. I can only imagine of what you were reminded of. I write those things down. And when I finish, I feel heard. My feelings are validated. Because I've been honest. I've been honest. Yeah. And oftentimes, isn't that what we are struggling with? We want to be heard. We want to be validated. We want to be understood. We want to be acknowledged. We don't want to be told you shouldn't feel that way.
Right. Absolutely. Do you work with clients one-to-one? Are you client-facing?
I am client-facing, yes.
And how does that, if anyone listening wanted to, you know, learn more about you and potentially work with you, how would they go about doing that?
Well, the easiest way to find out anything about me is on my website, which is youcanteatlove.com. And there's even a place where if you want to just message me, it comes to me. And as I often say, it is me. It's really me. No AI or, you know, virtual assistant chatbot or anything. No chatbot. It's just me.
Love
that. But the way that I'm speaking with you right now is the way that I speak with other people. We work through these things just as you and I have been working through stuff. And sometimes people get, you know, a little bit annoyed because I call them out on their garbage.
Sure.
But no, I've done it myself. I mean, I'm doing it myself. These are practices that I practice every single solitary day myself.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing is that you're just doing you and being how you are. And if they're uncomfortable, it's up to them to verbalize. Yeah,
exactly. 100%.
Yeah. Yep. Hear that.
You know, that's part of what we do. We discover whose voice you're really hearing. And that's often interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's gnarly work to do. I'm so happy to have met you and to have you here. I've adored
this. Has been fun.
This conversation, and I would love to have you back when your book is done.
Well, it will hopefully be published by the end of next week, I'm hoping. So
that's amazing.
Anyway, but I've got your email. I can send you a PDF copy of it.
I would love that so much. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a great conversation, and you keep doing what you are doing. Let's shift some lives, and I can't wait to see you do the parental shift. And I'm going to go ahead and invite myself onto the parental shift. So you need to send me a link as to what day you want me to show up.
I would love that so much. Yes, please. Welcome in. Come on in. And I would love to have you in there to give insight and to, you know, move the needle. Sometimes it can't just be the person facilitating these things, right? Like, there needs to be more community aspect too. And I would love for you to be a part of it. Honor.
I would love it.
Beautiful. Well, I will reach out to you soon, and I hope you just be all sorts of well.
And you as well. And to your listeners, to everyone who's listening out there, just know this: you are enough exactly as you are. And if you don't believe it, I will believe it for you until you can believe it for yourself.